All right, y'all, welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/scotthortonshow. All right, you guys, on the line, I've got Aaron Mate. He is the host of Pushback at thegrayzone.com, and of course writes there and at Real Clear Investigations and The Nation and other places, and this one is at The Gray Zone. It's kind of an addendum, and I guess this interview, too, isn't, well, not really. It's somewhat a different subject, but it's, in a way, it could be an addendum to our interview from last week or 2 weeks ago. About the OPCW and all the dissension within it. And this is really important. OPCW chief made false claims to denigrate Duma whistleblower, documents reveal. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Aaron?
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me back.
Very happy to have you here. So now I fumbled a little bit in that introduction because, in fact, our last interview was about an entirely different alleged chemical attack that there was dissent inside the OPCW over, and you published an open letter from the actual whistleblowers on the site. But now back to Duma, the ongoing saga about a year on now, it began about a year ago, where these whistleblowers started coming forward from, it's the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, and the guys who investigated the attack in Duma in April of 2018 in Syria, which was blamed on the regime, of course. And so a big part of that is it the only named whistleblower, Ian Henderson, has been really dragged through the mud for the last year. And now you finally have the proof that the draggers were bluffing and were wrong about his position there. Is that right?
That's right. What we've seen is basically a cover-up of the cover-up. So when Ian Henderson's report was leaked, it totally destroyed the narrative that the OPCW had publicly signed on to, because his engineering study concluded that the cylinders found at the scene of the alleged chemical attack in Duma were likely manually placed, not dropped from the sky by an aircraft. And the fact that this was kept out of the OPCW's official reports was a huge scandal, because it showed that their own inspectors had reached a completely different conclusion than what they put out publicly. And then we got even more leaks showing the censorship of even more evidence, including toxicology reports, the trace levels of chemical that were actually found at the scene, which showed that the level of chlorine at the scene in Duma was really no different than you would find in any normal household environment. And we saw that internal dissent from people like Henderson and the other whistleblower, showing that, complaining to top officials that their evidence was excluded and that they were being kept out of the process, and that basically all the people who went to Duma and collected the evidence were being excluded from the process that led to the OPCW's final report. So in response to all this, the OPCW leadership didn't address any of the censored findings. What they did is convened an inquiry into the leak of Henderson's report. When they released the results in February of this year, they didn't even accuse Henderson or the other whistleblower of the leak, because they couldn't find any evidence for that. But what they did do with their so-called inquiry is use it as an opportunity to paint them as rogue, uninformed, low-level inspectors who were just stubborn that their findings weren't accepted. And so with Henderson, they went so far as to basically lie about him, as we can prove now. They said that he was not a member of the fact-finding mission in Duma, and he was only there in, quote, a minor supporting role. And the documents that we've been leaked show this to be false. First of all, when it comes to the claim that Henderson is not a member, well, we have contemporaneous documents from the OPCW mission in Duma that show him listed under mission personnel as a member of the fact-finding mission, the FFM. We also got a notification document that was sent to the Syrian government, informing them that Henderson was joining the team as one of the inspectors going to Douma. And then when it comes to this claim from the OPCW that Henderson only played a minor supporting role, we got, I think, what is the most damning leak, which shows that it's a letter from the office of the director general at the time instructing the team to let Ian Henderson lead the inspections at the hospital where the alleged victims were taken to, and at the cylinders, basically at the crime scene. And so how can you claim someone's playing a minor supporting role when your own documents show that the OPCW leadership wanted him to lead the inspections of the crime scene, the most critical inspection of the entire mission?
Mm-hmm. And where they say ODG is happy if the visits to the cylinders and hospital are led by Ian Henderson, that does read very clearly as meaning that's their suggestion that he lead.
Yeah, that's what it was. This was a communication back to the team leader in Syria, and it's a document that is relaying all their instructions and their preferences. And yeah,
so they're not just happy, but that's a figure of speech, meaning they recommend it.
Yeah. And the reason why is obvious, is because Ian Henderson is the only member of that team with a high level of experience and training in chemical engineering and ballistics. And that is why he personally took the measurements of the cylinders in Douma. And when you have someone who personally took the measurements, who led the inspections, and then writes a report that undermines your narrative, it's an old trick. If you can't fight someone on the facts, you have to try to smear their reputation, smear their credibility. And that's what they tried to do. And they tried to do it by outright falsification. And then on top of the lies, then they try to give this phony narrative about why he was there to begin with, because they have to now explain how it is that this guy wrote this report and why he was a part of the mission. So what they said was it was basically happenstance that since he was in Syria anyway, to head the command post in Damascus, that it was customary that he assist the mission in Douma. And they try to play it off as basically incidental.
Right.
When meanwhile, we got another document showing that he only took over the command post after the Douma mission was complete. So basically, they both lied and they used very disingenuous language to try to downplay his role for obvious reasons.
Yep. And, you know, we should be clear that this was effective, that without this, at least there would have been whatever percent, if you want to try to quantify it, greater probability that somebody at the Post or the Times or the BBC or somewhere where it can be heard would cover this story. And instead, this is all the cover they need, the other kind of cover, to pretend that, oh, yeah, no, I heard somewhere that that was debunked and that that guy was a fraud. And then they don't have to cover it. And they probably weren't going to cover it anyway, but this just makes it that much easier for them to ignore.
Well, yeah, but the problem now is now that that's been shown to be a lie, you still have no coverage from any of
it. Yeah, because now it's too late, right? Now the story's not hot anymore. It broke a year ago, right? And you've been covering the hell out of it, but they never going to pick that up. Even Fox News won't pick it up, even though in a way it would. Well, yeah, because Trump led a bombing campaign over it. That's right.
You know, what's ironic here is that Fox News has actually done the best coverage of this scandal.
Tucker Carlson. Right.
Tucker Carlson has done this. But even you have reporters at the Fox News website who, when the first leaks came out last year in the fall, I believe, of 2019, you had even Fox News doing some stories about this. So even Fox News did more reporting than the New York Times did.
I wonder if somebody got fired over that. I can't figure out how that could be. But anyway, yeah, I hear you.
You know, I'll take it, you know,
sometimes the memo doesn't get passed around to everybody who was supposed to read it.
Yeah, but it's striking. And, you know, the only mention I've seen about it in the New York Times recently was it was sort of incidentally mentioned during in a profile of Elliot Higgins, the founder of Bellingcat, this, group that purports to do independent investigations, but is funded by groups, including the National Endowment for Democracy and the British government, and it tends to put forward so-called findings that advance, you know, Western government narratives. And in this profile, we learned that the founder of Bellingcat, Elliot Higgins, that he's even there's this line where it says that he attributes his expertise not to any special knowledge, but to playing video games. So that is who Western media is relying on for its experts on things like this gas attack, this alleged gas attack in Douma. And it mentions that there was a letter about this. There was some rumblings of some dissent. So basically the Times handled this by basically mentioning it in passing and then giving it no other attention after that. So that's how our propaganda system works. But look, when it comes to the facts of the matter here, it's overwhelming. I mean, this was a cover up and now they're trying to cover up the cover up.
Yeah. Well, and this was the third big fake gas attack in a row. You'd think they might have caught on by then, too.
Well, certainly there have been questions raised about the alleged attack in Ghouta. You know, Cy Hirsch did a whole bunch of reporting on this. Ted Postol, the MIT professor, did some studies showing that that was actually quite likely a staged attack. And then you have also doubts raised about Khan Shaykhun. You know, Cy Hirsch, again, did more reporting there. And there were others, too. Even with Douma, you know, all of these, just before you even consider the evidence, from the point of view of logic, make no sense. This idea that Assad would do the one thing that he knows will trigger a U.S. military response, and also do it while he's about to take over these key areas. For example, when this alleged attack happened in Douma, the Assad government was about to retake Douma. So from the point of view of logic, it never made any sense. But we've never had the level of documentation and just smoking gun evidence that we've had when it comes to Douma, because now you have the people who led the investigation into the alleged attack for the OPCW, people with, you know, just who have veteran experience at the OPCW. These guys are not rookies. They've been there with the OPCW since its founding, basically, mm-hmm. in 1997, saying that this was staged, that this was a fraud. And it is a striking commentary on our media system that, you know, it's only those of us at the relative margins who have been covering it.
Yeah. Hey, y'all, check it out. The Libertarian Institute, that's me and my friends, have published three great books this year. First is No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg. He was the best one of us. Now he's gone, but this great collection is a truly fitting legacy for his fight for freedom. I know you'll love it. Then there's Coming to Palestine by the great Sheldon Richman. It's a collection of 40 important essays he's written over the years about the truth behind the Israel-Palestine conflict. You'll learn so much and highly value this definitive libertarian take on the dispossession of the Palestinians and the reality of their brutal occupation. And last but not least is the great Ron Paul, The Scott Horton Show Interviews, 2004 through 2019. Interview transcripts of all of my interviews of the Good Doctor over the years, on all the wars, money, taxes, the police state, and more. So how do you like that? Pretty good, right? Find them all at libertarianinstitute.org/books. Hey, you guys may know I'm involved in some Libertarian Party politics this year, but you can't hear or read about that at the Libertarian Institute due to 501c3 rules and such. So make sure to sign up for the interviews feed at scotthorton.org and keep an eye on my blog at scotthorton.org/stress. Hey y'all, Scott here. If you want a real education in history and economics, you should check out Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. Tom and a really great group of professors and experts have put together an entire education of everything they didn't teach you in school but should have. Follow through from the link in the margin at scotthorton.org. for Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom.
So I did see on Twitter I was lurking. I'm trying to quit again. I did. I quit again. Twitter. but I was lurking a little bit, and I saw where you tangled with the guys from Bellingcat, and they said, oh, come on. This document, Aaron, doesn't say what you say it says. It has him on the same list with the chauffeur and the refrigerator repairman or something. And so there's nothing on there that would indicate that he was any kind of team leader there, you disingenuous third-rate reporter, you.
Yes, and I pointed out that, you know, given that these guys are literally funded by Western taxpayers, that we're really not getting the sharpest knives in the drawer, because what they missed on that document is that, you know, it says mission personnel. And then when someone is an interpreter, it says interpreter. Or when someone is a driver, it says driver. And then when you get to Ian Henderson's name, it says FFM, fact-finding mission. you know, right. which means that he was not, you know, he was a member of the mission. That's what it says right there. So they actually ended up, I think, deleting. Yeah, they deleted those tweets.
Yeah.
And one of them even actually acknowledged that he was wrong. But, you know, look, it's.
Hey, that's a lot of taking responsibility from those guys who never do. So call that
is,
a win.
Well, and, you know, it is. And, you know, the real significance of them is that they work. There are strong indications that they were a part of the fraud. So, for example, the leaked report from Ian Henderson, it references that there have been other voices weighing in on what happened in Douma. And Henderson writes a line about, quote, supposed experts. And what he's saying is that, you know, these supposed experts have been consulted by the OPCW in the effort to, you know, find out what happened. And so what Ian Henderson is saying, I mean, that's pretty harsh language for an experienced investigator to refer to someone else who the OPCW is using as a supposed expert. And we don't know exactly who they are, and we don't even know who ultimately the OPCW ended up relying on for its quote-unquote expertise after it excluded Henderson's report. But there are reasons to speculate that Bellingcat might have been among those groups of supposed experts. One indication is that Bellingcat, in its policy document that it uploaded in the fall of 2019, it listed a whole bunch of groups that it claims that it partners with. And the OPCW was among those groups. Then you had months and months and months of leaks showing the Douma cover-up and what a fraud it was. And you had the OPCW being embarrassed. And all of a sudden in February, so like 5 months later, all of a sudden Elliot Higgins of Bellingcat posts a tweet saying, "Hey everyone, our original policy document made a mistake. We have nothing to do with the OPCW or its investigation of Douma. What happened was there, that was a copy and paste error where I copied a bunch of names from the wrong list. So I'm correcting it." So they correct it, but the only name of an organization that he takes off their list in the correction is the OPCW. Mm-hmm. So basically, the only error in that copy and paste error, he says, was the OPCW. He still works with everybody else, but the only one who he's now saying he does not work with happens to be the organization that is now mired in a massive cover-up scandal.
Yeah. Well, and as you're pointing out here, everybody who actually was on the team in Douma investigating the thing, everything that they contributed was thrown out, and it was the other group, the bosses and the group in Turkey, that later drummed this up. So they might have needed the manpower since they'd gotten rid of all of their best guys.
Well, you know, what's funny is that both these inspectors came back to the OPCW after their initial tenure. And the reason they came back was because the OPCW had a real absence of people at their expertise level. I mean, these were people who were with the OPCW since its formation. So the OPCW hired them back because they needed them. And these guys are very proud of their experience. You can tell that from what we've heard of from them publicly. And we also published in this new report at the Gray Zone some excerpts from appraisal letters that Henderson got from the OPCW, basically saying one of them says he's the best inspection team leader that the OPCW has. He's relied on for his expertise. So these people are people with high levels of integrity and also and expertise and also bravery, because, you know, it's not an easy gig to go into Douma, into a town that's just been cleared of, an occupation by militants, to go and into a crime scene, you know, crawl on your hands and knees, measuring cylinders and a crater hole. I mean, this is dangerous work.
Well, and talk a little bit about Henderson's character. I mean, he has not talked to the media at all, right? He just gave a deposition to the United Nations only, right?
Well, no, he's someone who has respected the OPCW process. And so the only capacity in which he's spoken publicly has been through testifying to the UN Security Council or in responding to the OPCW inquiry that smeared him. So he wrote a response letter to the OPCW Inspector General that just like rebuts all of his points. And he wrote that along with the other inspector, Inspector B.
But it sounds like he's very deliberately staying away from anyone's partisan use or anything like that. He's not even going on the BBC for that matter, right?
That's right. He's not given a single interview. And that's because I think
all just official channels only, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
That's exactly right. And because he respects the OPCW, you can sense that he takes a lot of pride in the work that he did. And he actually cares about the OPCW's reputation and its independence. In this case, it was totally abused. I mean, you can see it, for example, you look at the first draft of the interim report that Inspector B actually wrote. And then you compare that to what was published, and you see all the critical things that their superiors just censored. And you have leaked emails of complaints saying, you know, why did you censor this critical evidence? It creates a totally misleading picture. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing what's happened to these guys, and to see that, you know, for trying to stand up for science and for their own investigation and for the integrity of the organization, how the organization's leadership has thrown them under the bus.
Yeah. And by the way, audience, that deposition of Ian Henderson, that videotape testimony to the United Nations, is really highly recommended viewing, too. You really get a sense for who he is, and then to hear it from the horse's mouth is really a big deal there. And that's available on YouTube. But now, so let me give you just a couple of minutes here at the very end. There's been big developments in the Russiagate thing, and I don't think we can cover all the different angles, but I guess especially I wanted to hear from you, if I could, Aaron, about the released testimony from the House of Representatives. And to me, in order of importance, would be the admissions by the high-level members of Obama's administration about what they knew and what they thought of it all. And then the CrowdStrike thing, if you can, fit that in. But especially Clapper and Lynch and the rest of the testimony revealed in these House transcripts. Oh, and I'm sorry, let me mention that you had this other great article at The Gray Zone that was all about this. That was the spotlight on antiwar.com yesterday. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, to me, the CrowdStrike admission is the most significant because, look, before even this, you know, fraudulent thing about collusion came about, you had the allegation that Russia stole emails from the DNC. That's Russiagate's underlying crime. Now we learn from the cyber firm CrowdStrike that generated the hacking allegation and whose findings and forensics were relied on by U.S. intelligence officials, that they actually found no evidence that these alleged Russian hackers actually exfiltrated anything from the server. And we're only finding this out now. I mean, to me, it's like one of the biggest revelations yet, because it calls into question the entire the underlying crime upon which Russiagate is based, that the firm that first accused Russia of stealing emails actually has no evidence that these alleged Russian hackers took anything from the server. I mean, it's a big admission, and it's, to me, it's quite stunning, but I guess we shouldn't be surprised anymore that we're only finding it out now. And then you have, Obama officials saying they never saw any evidence of a conspiracy, which of course is different than the picture that a lot of them gave to the public. And you have intelligence officials like Andy McCabe saying that he made the most amazing admission. So the entire Trump-Russia investigation starts with this tip that the FBI gets from the Australian government, from this official, Alexander Downer, which says that he's overheard George Papadopoulos, this low-level volunteer, suggesting that Russia gave some kind of unclear suggestion about helping the Trump campaign. So they open up the entire investigation based on that. Now we hear from Andrew McCabe. He said, oh yeah, we never really thought it was Papadopoulos who was communicating with the Russians. So if you don't think Papadopoulos isn't communicating with the Russians, how can you justify opening up and continuing and extending a conspiracy investigation based on what Papadopoulos may have said? I mean, it's just ridiculous, and it's amazing that we get this now. It's amazing that Adam Schiff went out and told the public that there was secret evidence of collusion that he couldn't reveal, while meanwhile behind closed doors he was hearing again and again that there was no evidence of collusion. And it just speaks to, look, this whole thing was based on a scam, and it's a question of now, with CrowdStrike's admission, how far did the scam go? Does the scam also include concocting this allegation about Russian hackers stealing the emails? I think it does, but you know, we need to see more evidence. We need to see the reports that CrowdStrike submitted, which we still haven't seen, and whatever other evidence the Mueller used to accuse Russia of this hack. Because you know, every single pillar continues to crumble, including, by the way, the social media ads too. When a Russian troll farm was indicted, that was compared to Pearl Harbor, these dumb ads that nobody saw that weren't even about the election. Mueller recently, or Mueller prosecutors recently dropped that case because, and they made the laughable claim that through the discovery process, it could be a threat to national security, which is just a joke, like everything else in Russiagate.
Yeah. And isn't it remarkable, too, that it did not leak in a Republican-controlled Congress, too, that Clapper testified today. Former Attorney General Lynch testified today that they know of no evidence of any conspiracy between the Trump campaign and the Russians. That was in all of this is from December of 2017, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Clapper did say publicly a couple times, you know, in interviews that he never saw any evidence of collusion. But at the same time, then he went out and, you know, with suggestive language and innuendo, also fed the narrative as well. But I think the striking admissions are the CrowdStrike one, where, you know, we were told for 3 years that, you know, Russia destroyed our democracy by hacking some emails. And we were never told by anybody, including the Republicans, that actually their main source for this, CrowdStrike, didn't have any evidence of it.
Yeah. Although we knew that all along, because they said that the reason they knew is because there was a reference to Iron Felix in there, and because they had some Cyrillic writing in the Guccifer II version of some of these records or whatever, which was laughable at the time. And, you know, I'm sure you probably are familiar with this guy, Jeffrey Carr, the computer security expert. But he said at the time that it's impossible for anyone to say with 100% certainty who hacked a computer by examining that computer. It's just it's too easy to fake it. But there's only one group in the world, and this is what Binney... William Binney said on my show a few months after that, back in 2016, or maybe beginning of 2017, there's one group of people in the world who can tell you with 100% certainty who hacked what, and that would be the NSA, because they can rewind and watch anything that ever happened on the internet. They own the whole thing, with a capital P. And so, but nobody else can. And so... You know, the fact that they're not the ones vouching for all this, but they're just not disputing what the FBI heard from CrowdStrike. Oh, and this is my favorite part, actually, of the transcript. And I'm sorry, I'm keeping you over time. My favorite part of the transcript is where the guy from CrowdStrike says, in response to Eric Swalwell, says, well, do you know of any other information about when they might have exfiltrated it? And he goes, that would shed any more light on what happened here? And... the Walker from CrowdStrike says, well, essentially, I saw in the media that the government says the Russians did it.
Yeah, exactly.
When, of course, they heard it from him.
Yeah, exactly. They were the ones. I mean, when they first made that allegation, it was in the Washington Post, June 2016, and that set this whole thing off. And now they're trying to use this circular thing. Well, oh, really? It was the U.S. government that reached that conclusion. It's ridiculous. Another very funny thing from Sean Henry of CrowdStrike in that testimony. And then I have to go.
Oh, so I said asked, Walker. I'm sorry. It was anyway. Go ahead.
Yeah. So he's asked. All right. So if you don't have any evidence of that they actually exfiltrated the emails, that they actually took them off the server, how could they have then taken all these emails? And Sean Henry literally says the Russians could have taken screenshots of every single email as Democratic, as DNC employees read them. So imagine Russian hackers in Moscow or whatever taking screenshots of tens of thousands of emails, and how much time that would take and how ridiculous that is, especially since we know that all these emails had DNC metadata in them. So it's just like this guy who the US government relied on and who the DNC used to remediate the breach of its server seems to be pretty clueless on things more than just the issue of whether or not there's evidence of Russians stealing emails.
Yep. All right, you guys. I'm sorry. I got to let him go. He's got to go. But it's the great Aaron Mate at the Gray Zone. Pushback is the name of the show, and all his great articles are there, too. Thank you again for your time.
Thanks, Scott.
The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM. In LA, APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.